Ruth chapter 1 verses 1 to 22. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there.
Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law. Arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning.
Now, I wonder, the last thing that you underestimated, I wonder what it was. What was the very last thing you underestimated? For me, it was yesterday, actually. I live in Westfield, and I made the mistake of underestimating how long it would take to pop into Hastings yesterday. Did anyone drive down the Settlescombe Road yesterday? I thought I'd pop in, be back in half an hour. No, I don't think so. But anyway, it is. It can be very inconvenient to underestimate things, can't it? It can sometimes be a little bit dangerous. I don't think there is around the coast here, but certainly the coast of Cornwall, they have something called a riptide that you have to be very careful about. You mustn't underestimate the power of the sea. I suspect it's a little bit like that here too sometimes. Of course, there's lots of other things that people have underestimated down through the years, a bit more serious than just driving into town. Things like the Russian winter. Napoleon underestimated the Russian winter, as did Hitler, of course, much to their misfortune. Underestimating things, it's often a very dangerous thing to do. But of course, the biggest mistake that anybody can make in terms of underestimating things is the sovereignty, the size, the power of God. And how often we do that, we underestimate the sovereignty of God, his power. Why do we do it? All kinds of reasons, I think. I think maybe it's to do with the fact that in the West we have this tradition of liberty. We cherish, quite rightly in a way, our freedom of choice. After all, we choose our rulers, for better or for worse. And so people say, well, we choose our rulers, so that runs on that we choose our God as well. We choose our religion. We choose what God is like. Someone once said, God has made man in his own image, and man has returned the compliment. And I think that's true. But the Bible is very clear. We might kick against it as those who live in a democratic West, but it's there. God is an absolute monarch. In the best sense, he is a dictator. Now, of course, I don't mean a dictator like the evil dictators we've seen, like Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler. But in the right sense, what he says goes. He is a dictator. He dictates what happens. God is supreme. God is sovereign, as the Bible puts it, because all events are in his hands. But in the Bible, as you hear about that, you realize very quickly there's actually a fantastic balance in the Bible. And the book we come to now, this little book of Ruth, shows that really clearly. So let's have a look at this book together, shall we? This wonderful little book of Ruth, only four chapters long. But it emerges after the great sagas of the Judges. And if you've been with us for the last few months, you remember we've been having a look at the stories of the Judges. And do you remember as we got to the book of Judges, we saw that God has done extraordinary things for the people of Israel. Back through the deliverance from Egypt in slavery, the people were rescued, then they were settled in the land. And then we saw that as they settled in the land, under the rule of the Judges, over and over again, they disobeyed God. Do you remember that? And we saw the characters who came and rescued them, like Gideon and so on. And we saw punishment, and we saw discipline. And of course, we saw disaster as they go their own way, as the people go their own way, and they don't go God's way. Now, maybe for us, as we look around the world, it's not too difficult to see the sovereignty of God in the affairs of the world, of the nations. We can sort of look on a big scale and say, yes, I can understand that God is in control of the movement of armies and nations and big decisions from presidents. Yes, I can see God in control of that. But what about individuals and families? How does God being in charge, being sovereign, work in a family situation? What about you and me personally, day by day? What about God's sovereignty and then the problem of suffering and tragic events? Now, I don't think it's any accident at all that this little book of Ruth comes after all those sagas of the Judges. Because it's a reminder that the sovereignty of God is not just about great movements of armies and nations, but it's also about your life and my life. So let's come and look at Ruth together. Well, it's a great little book. Someone once said it was the perfect short story. It certainly is, because it concerns one particular family. It concerns death and love and marriage. I suppose it's a Bible soap opera, if you like. It's more than that, but it concerns family life. And it's the kind of life that we would understand. But as I said, the book opens, as you can look at verse 1, The book opens, it says, in the day when the judges judged. And that does give a bit of a key as to what this book is about. It's the time of the judges. And as I mentioned, this is the time when people were turning away from God. The people of Israel were refusing to acknowledge his sovereignty. They were heading towards disaster. Do you remember when we looked at the judges? We saw that there was a kind of spiral of disaster. After one after another, the judges came and rescued the people, but then they disobeyed, and there was kind of a spiral like that. And that's what this little book fits into. And have a look at just the previous page. Can you see, do you remember how the book of Judges ends? We mentioned it several times when we were looking at those stories. The very last verse, it says, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. So that's the situation coming into this book. So what does Ruth do? Well, this little book, it narrows down on one family at this terrifically turbulent time. And the reason it's there is because it shows there are still believers around. There are still people who are trusting God, still people trusting the Lord in their daily lives with the Lord as their God, trusting and obeying and walking with him. And it's not just limited to Israelites, as we're going to see. It's actually foreigners who believe in God as well, the Lord of Israel. And I'm sure this book was a lesson for the Israelites when they first read it and first remembered it. If only all of them had obeyed and followed like some of the characters in the book we're going to look at. If they'd followed like Ruth and Naomi and Boaz, who we're going to see next time. See how things could have been. There needn't have been that spiral of disobedience if only they'd obeyed God as Ruth and Naomi and Boaz had. One commentator, Leon Morris, says this. I thought it was a nice little summary. He says, most of all, this book, Ruth, is a book about God. It deals with unimportant people, unimportant matters, but it deals with them in such a way as to show that God is active in the affairs of men. He works his purpose out and blesses those that trust him. I think above all, Ruth is a great reminder of that marvellous verse in Romans 8:28. I'm sure you know it. God works for the good of those who love him. So let's get into the first chapter, shall we? And let's have a look at our first point, which is problems now and events past. Just glance down at verses 1 to 5, please. Verses 1 to 5. Now, I don't know what you do when you meet someone for the very first time. It's very easy to pigeonhole people, isn't it? We tend to do that as human beings. We listen to how they speak, their accent. We notice how they dress. We notice their manner. Because we're all results of our backgrounds. And it's also true, if it's true about the way that we are in our presentation, it's also true in terms of the problems that we have faced and continue to face. All of us are the results of what's happened in the years gone by, whether they're things that we've deliberately chosen or whether they're the things beyond our control. Now today I think there's quite a tendency to blame any problems we have now on things that have happened in the past. And I think there's a strong case for that in some cases. People say, it was the way I was brought up, that's why I've got problems now. And there may be truth in that. Or I was treated badly as a child. And it may be true that the problems today are genuinely because of that. But sometimes problems come simply because of the way we've reacted to circumstances in the past. And I think we have to be honest that quite often the problems that we have now may well be the result of decisions that we have personally made. Now Naomi, as we look at verses 1 to 5, this lady has faced big decisions, or is facing big decisions, because of a previous decision of her husband. So look at verse 1. We hear that there was a famine where Naomi lived, and she was married to Elimelech. We don't know why there was a famine. It could have been because, do you remember the story of Gideon, where the Midianites are invading and stealing all the food? So it could well be that there's a famine because of the attacks of the Midianites. We don't know. Whatever the reason is, Elimelech decides to take his little family to Moab. As you can see on the map, that's down in the south beyond the Dead Sea. Now, was he doing the right thing? Famine in the land, he decides, I'm going to take my family away to where there's some food. Sounds fair enough. Bit of a questionable decision, though. Because Moab, down there, they had some decidedly dubious practices. The Moabites worshipped a rather horrific god called Chemosh, as we heard in Judges 3, demanded human sacrifice. We know the Moabites had Israelites as slaves as well. So it's a bit of a questionable decision to take his family down there. Maybe he was just being very practical. Maybe they were quite syncretistic. In other words, they had lots of gods and goddesses. Maybe they thought, well, we'll be tolerated down there. We worship the Lord, so maybe we'll be tolerated. And certainly there's going to be food down in that area, which they haven't got in Israel. And it does seem maybe it's just going to be for a while. The suggestion possibly at the beginning of verse 2 is that they do have some wealth. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to just abandon everything and move to a new country. But as often with wealthy families, they can get out when the trouble comes. Actually, I was a little bit reminded of before the Second World War, those who knew what was coming, quite a few people who were wealthy enough went off to Canada, I think, didn't they? And I suspect probably people in this area, if they could afford it, would move into the countryside to avoid the bombing. So that was the kind of scenario, I think, that we're thinking about here. So is Elimelech and Naomi, are they showing lack of faith as they're moving down to Moab? Well, there's no evidence in the text that they consulted God. It doesn't say they didn't, but there's no evidence that they prayed about their future. Well, whatever happened, in seeking security, as we heard in the story, they didn't find it. Because, tragically, Elimelech dies, and Naomi is left husbandless, and then 10 years later, Mahlon and Chilion, the two children, the two boys, die as well. So Naomi is now left husbandless and childless in a foreign land. Just perhaps a little reminder before we go any further about our dependence. What do we depend on? Those investments, are we putting more dependence on those than trusting God? So Naomi is now left with tough decisions coming out of this tragedy. It is actually clear that she does still trust in God, though. And I wonder if you notice, she never falls into that false logic, despite all the tragic things that happened to her. This false logic, have you heard people say this? How could God let this happen to me? Therefore, God doesn't exist. Have you heard people say that? How could God let this happen to me? Therefore, God doesn't exist. Which is a completely illogical thing to say. You can understand why people might say that, coming out of tragedy, because people don't think logically in tragedy often, do they? But taking it away from that, it doesn't make any sense at all, does it? And Naomi never falls into that trap. Never denies that God's in charge at all, as we'll see. Sometimes we do make decisions we regret. Of course we do. Perhaps you and I are facing sadness today, even tragedy. Well, be encouraged, because the Lord deals kindly with Naomi, as we'll see, as we look at the story of Ruth. So let's move on then to the next verses, verses 6 to 13, which is about God's providence, which I've called Providence, God's Picture, Our Jigsaw. Come back to the jigsaw in a minute. Now, I don't know what you feel when people say to you things like, good luck. Has anyone said that to you today? Or have you heard people say, oh, go on, take a chance on it, take a chance. Or even, touch wood. You hardly ever hear today the Christian alternative, which is to rely on God's providence. It sounds a very old-fashioned word, but I don't make any apology for it, because it's a good biblical word. It's an old-fashioned word, but it means to see in advance or to provide for. To see in advance or provide for. And what it's saying, this word, is that it's not only that God has created the universe, created the world and you and I, but he also sustains it. He sustains the universe. The universe depends on God for its continuing as well as for its existing. What this word means is that he's ruling creation. Nothing happens in the universe that's beyond God's government, his control. What's the alternative to that? You see, luck and fate and chance, touch wood, are blind. But God is seeing. Luck and fate and chance are impersonal, but God is our loving Father. Luck and fate and chance can't speak. They're dumb. But God speaks. You see, in a universe governed by God, there are no chance events. And that should be terrifically encouraging for you and me. But now, as you're thinking about that, maybe you're thinking, well, hang on, what about my ability to decide? What about my will? Well, it seems quite clear in the scripture that we do have wills. We do make things happen. We have the ability to decide. It's part of us being in the image of God. The ability to decide right and wrong, for example. But the Bible does insist that our power to cause things to happen has to be secondary to God's power. You see, his sovereign providence stands over our actions. The Bible really does say that he works out his will through the actions of human wills without violating the freedom of those human wills. Now that's quite difficult to get your mind around, but perhaps an example would make it clear. Do you remember the story of Joseph in Genesis? Do you remember in the story of Joseph, his brothers planned to get rid of him? And do you remember they put him down a well and they sell him into slavery and so on? And I won't go through the whole story, but do you remember eventually he's in charge of Egypt as many years have gone by, and the brothers come to get food from Joseph. And when they discover who he is, his brothers are terrified because they think that Joseph's going to get his own back on them for being mean to them all those years before. But Joseph says these remarkable words. He says, after all that they've done to him, he says to them, "You meant it for harm, God meant it for good." That's Genesis 50, verse 20. You meant it for harm, God meant it for good. And I think that's a beautiful little summary of how God's sovereignty and our ability to decide work together. So here in Ruth, you see the same kind of thing. When we get to the end of the story, we're going to see that God puts all the pieces together for Naomi. It makes sense for her to go home now, as we come to this part of the story, because she hears that the famine is finished in Israel, so it makes sense, so it's her decision. But of course we know with the overarching picture of the story that it's God's will that she does, because there's a bigger purpose there. And God's purpose is that her daughter-in-law, Ruth, is going to meet this wonderful man, Boaz, and they are going to become great King David's great-grandparents. Now, of course, Naomi had no idea of that when she made the decision to go back to Israel, but it was part of God's plan, through her decision, that actually that's what would happen. And there's no hint, by the way, in the text that God's total control is limiting Naomi's action at all. You see, there's a great truth in this, that God never acts intermittently on a whim, but he acts continuously. God never acts kind of like we do, on a whim, or just a decision. When you see something, you buy it, and so on. God never acts like that. And actually, Naomi does know that. If you just glance down to verse 21, these very negative little words that she says, "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty," and so on. "Don't call me Naomi, and call me bitter," she says later on. Yes, she's bitter, but what keeps her sweet, if you like, is the consciousness that God is there at every moment. And she still talks about God's kindness. This is in verse 7 and 8. Talks about God's kindness, knowing that God still, despite all she's experienced, God is in charge. In spite of her suffering, she recognizes God is love and has good plans for his people. So why am I talking about jigsaws there? I don't know if you do jigsaws at home. Anyone do jigsaws? Yeah. We have a bit of a rule in our household, and that is, it's my wife's rule, I have to confess, not mine, we have a bit of a rule that we don't look at the picture on the box. Anyone have that rule? Yeah? I don't like that rule at all. It's a horrible rule. But if you like, it's a good illustration of the way that we cope with or come to terms with God's sovereignty. You see, in this story, Naomi only has the pieces of the jigsaw, but she knew that God had the bigger picture. So we only sometimes see the pieces. We only see the pieces, and sometimes they're awkward, aren't they? Sometimes those pieces don't seem to fit very well, and we can't see how they make up that bigger picture. They're very awkward, and there's a bit that's a funny shape. Do you see what I'm saying? But God has the bigger picture. So what do we say, more seriously, with tragedy today? What do we say when we're faced with horrific situations? When you see children dying and so on? Well, there's two things that the Bible asserts. One is about pain and anger. Just have a look at verse 13. So this is Naomi talking to her daughters-in-law. She says, "Would you wait until they grow up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it's more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." Have you noticed how many times in the Bible people get angry with God? The Bible is always honest about anger. I wonder if you remember the story of Jeremiah. Jeremiah in chapter 20 says, "Cursed be the day I was born." Do you remember in the Psalms the way that King David almost metaphorically shakes his fist at God? There's a need to be honest with God. There is an anger, I think, which is biblical. There is a right way of saying, "Why, Lord?" So there is pain and there is anger, but again, this has to be brought in line with trust and faith. And we see that in Jeremiah, for example. The Bible asserts nothing happens by chance. God's back is never turned. So that means when the question why comes, maybe we need to say, we don't know. We don't know why. You see, in the Bible, so often people endure tragedy, but their trust in God is there all stronger. I think that the most extraordinary verse about this is in Job. If you know the story of Job, what he suffered, this is what Job says, Job 13, verse 15. He says, though, talking about God, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Though he slay me, yet I will trust him. This is not saying that God is capricious or vengeful, but when we actively submit to the sovereign Lord, the God of all power and wisdom and love, he does work for the good of those he loves. And the book of Ruth shows that. And then finally, perseverance, trusting God. And this is verses 14 to 22. And both Naomi and Ruth are great examples of this. And maybe that hit you as we were hearing the story read. So, Naomi and Ruth in verses 20 and 21, first of all. Don't call me Naomi, says Naomi to the people when she goes home to Bethlehem. Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune on me. So Naomi does go home and she returns with Ruth. And Ruth, what an example of faithfulness Ruth was. She stuck with Naomi right the way through. And no doubt as they approach Bethlehem, everyone finds it extraordinary to see her again. And no doubt her friends and her extended family are shocked by these words. Now she's not bitter against God. Did you notice that? But what she's saying is, for some reason, my experience has been a bitter one. And I think there's a bit of a need to be honest that sometimes God does deal this way with us. But as he empties us, it's often to fill us up with good. And as we go through the story over the next weeks, you'll see that Naomi's bitterness becomes joy. And let's just take a look at that, shall we? Would you turn over to chapter 4, which is the last chapter? And shall we just have a look at the last paragraph or so, just to see how this fits in and how Naomi's bitterness, Mara, becomes joy. So let's have a look over a few pages at chapter 4, verses 14 to 17. So this is the very end of the story. Let's start from verse 13, shall we? Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. When he made love to her, to the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, that's Ruth, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed, and he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So God provides Ruth with Boaz and a grandson who will be the father of King David. So what's this saying? Well, isn't it saying the same thing that the cross was saying? That out of that cry of agony, my God, why have you forsaken me, from the Lord Jesus? As his disciples were watching that moment of horror, which didn't seem to have any purpose, just seemed to have tragedy, out of that moment came the salvation of the world. Out of Jesus' pain, which was ours, comes forgiveness, new life, and hope. So what's the lesson of this little bit of Ruth? Well, the lesson, I think, is this. Whatever our past or present experience, are we prepared to stop fighting God and to start trusting him? Are we ready to stop going alone and start giving everything to God? Are we prepared, you and I, to trust him even when it's painful? Trust him forward into what is dark and dangerous. Just turn back to chapter 1 for a moment, would you? We'll just have a look at the very last verse. It's only a little thing, but I think it's significant as we finish the rather dark chapter 1 of Ruth. Look at verse 22. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem. When? As the barley harvest was beginning. Appropriate for today. So there is food for both Naomi and Ruth. The future is always bright as we trust the promises of God. Let's bow our heads to pray, shall we? Father, we do thank you, first of all, for your sovereignty and your power. Thank you for the encouragement that all things are in your care and in your love and in your purposes. But Father, when we find it difficult to fit that together into our own lives, please give us the confidence and remind us to trust you with our daily lives. Forgive us when we fail to do that. And help us, whatever comes today or this week or in the future, to trust you with every moment of our lives. For Jesus' sake. Amen.